Kurt Vonnegut, the American author, is one of the science fiction writers who have been accepted by the literary establishment. From his first book, Play a Piano, a satire on the American meritocracy, through to Slaughterhouse-5, a novel about the firebombing of Dresden, Vonnegut has used science fiction not to indulge his own sense of fantasy, but to comment on his own society. First, we'll see part of a conversation between the poet Adrian Mitchell and Kurt Vonnegut. We close with another excerpt from the filmed interview. Adrian Mitchell arranged to meet Vonnegut at the house of Jeremy Brooks, the writer. And although they had never met, and Vonnegut was tired after a promotional tour of this country, they talked for most of an afternoon. Mitchell has always admired Vonnegut's work, but they didn't only talk about his writing. Among other things, they discussed war, anthropology, the raising of children, and of course, science fiction.
Yes, well, they're celebrating some sort of anniversary on Tralfamador, and so they send a messenger from one edge of the universe to the other, carrying a message, which is greetings.
First one I ever read of yours, first of your novels I ever read was Cat's Cradle. I read it 3 times, I think, in a year. And that was published in 1963.
Yes.
And in that, the sort of main characters, well, there's one dead before the book begins, really, is Felix Honecker, one of the fathers of the atomic bomb.
Yes.
Who invents this thing called Ice-9, which can freeze the whole world.
Well, there's a nice little story associated with that. The model for the character of Felix Honecker was Dr. Irving Langmuir, who is the only scientist working for private industry who ever won the Nobel Prize. He worked for General Electric, and I was a public relations man for General Electric, and my brother was a scientist who worked with Langmuir, so I got to know Langmuir well. And I heard this story about a visit H.G. Wells made to Schenectady long before I got there. But Schenectady is an engineer's town, a scientist's town, and nobody there is particularly presentable. Nobody reads a book because they have other things to do. And the General Electric Company was hysterical when they found that Wells wanted to have a look at the General Electric Company, and they didn't have anybody to receive this great man except their own great man. It was a very absent-minded Dr. Langmuir, so they said to Langmuir, all right, you've got to greet Wells. And so Langmuir said, well, I don't know what to say to him. Perhaps I can make up a story for him that he'll like and can use. And so Langmuir sat down and sketched out this science fiction story, which was about a form of ice which was stable at above room temperature, which would mean that the world would be frozen most of the time. And he told Wells this story, and apparently Wells didn't hear it, or at least Wells certainly wasn't very interested and passed through Schenectady and went somewhere else. And I heard this story about the meeting between Wells and Langmuir. Wells was dead. Langmuir died soon after I heard the story. And so I said, well, I guess that story's mine if I want to use it. So I did, and that was Cat's Cradle.
Yes. The other main character, is Bakunin. Bakunin.
Yes.
Who leads the Bakuninist religion, which has its own language for its own ideas, like Foma are harmless untruths, or works of fiction, in fact.
Yes.
Although I suppose works of fiction can be harmful.
No, I don't think so. Cat's Cradle is based on the religion of Bakuninism, and Bakuninism, the first word in the Bible of Bakunin, the first sentence in the Bible of Bakuninism announces that the whole religion is a fake, that everything in this Bible is a lie. And actually, it's an expression of my wish to make up better myths than we now have.
Yeah.
And I did study anthropology at the University of Chicago, and what is beneficial about the study of anthropology is that you discover that human beings can believe absolutely anything without any harmful effects, which leaves us free to lie as much as we want. And there are a lot of American myths now, for instance, which I don't like very much and which are very dangerous. And I'd like to replace them with something else, and I think this is possible. And any violence there is in the American character has to do with the myths which are floating around. And it wasn't viciousness that brought the cowboy myth into being, or the gun-loving myth into being about Americans. This is a storytelling problem. It's a matter of a country needing a hell of a lot of stories written in a hurry. And so the shootout that occurs at the end of so many American stories is simply the problem of, you know, we're out of town, or we're out of time, or we're out of space in this magazine or on this television show. We've got to end it, and we've got to end it in a way that the audience will leave the audience satisfied, and this is with death. And so here, what is supposed to be entertainment, the person who provides the entertainment is the writer, who has to end it satisfactorily. So we got this myth that came into being, and children believe it, and they grow up and they become adults, and they think that America, American history was made with a gun.
Then there's, in 1965, God bless you, Mr. Rosewater, appeals before swine. And that's the millionaire Elliot P. Rosewater spreading, trying to love unlovable people.
He's extremely wealthy, yes. He gives his money away in very small parcels. Like $25 here, $15 there.
Yeah. It's sort of more overtly political than most of your novels, I guess, with the money river.
Well, yes. Well, there's great reluctance in the United States to give poor people money. It's assumed to be bad for them. And Elliot Rosewater, as I say, his gifts are small, is when money is given away by a foundation ordinarily in the United States. It's quite large, on the order of $50,000 or $100,000, and for some noble purpose. And Elliot Rosewater gives somebody $27 because he needs $27. He buys one person a motorcycle because he wants a motorcycle so much.
Elliot's father says it's still possible for an American to make a fortune on his own. And Elliot says, sure, provided somebody tells him when he's young enough that there is a money river, that there's nothing fair about it, that he'd damn well better forget about hard work and the merit system and honesty and all that crap and get to where the river is. Go where the rich and the powerful are, I'd tell him, and learn their ways. They can be flattered and they can be scared. Please them enormously or scare them enormously, and one moonless night they will put their fingers to their lips, warning you not to make a sound, and they will lead you through the dark to the widest, deepest river of wealth ever known to man. You'll be shown your place on the riverbank and handed a bucket all your own. Slurp as much as you want, but try to keep the racket of your slurping down. A poor man might hear. Money River. And that novel ends with Indianapolis consumed by a fast storm.
Yes, well, that's perverse and personal, and I can't really explain that. I grew up in Indianapolis, yes, and I would like to see it burned down, or when I wrote the book, I would have liked to have seen it burned down, but that would take a lot of explaining. I assume it's really not a very bad place.
I think everyone's got an Indianapolis. Well, I've got Isha Surrey.
You have what?
Isha Surrey.
Oh.
Yes.
Well, Indianapolis is the world's largest city, not on a navigable waterway, which gives it a very special quality. There's no river there, and there's no other city in the world like it for lack of water.
And then 1969, Slaughterhouse-Five, or The Children's Crusade, you wrote, which is the book based on the fact that you were an American prisoner of war in Dresden, in a cool locker underneath a slaughterhouse.
Yeah.
And when you came out, the on February 30, 1945, the British and Americans had bombed the city into ashes.
Yeah.
And
yeah. What they created a firestorm.
Yes.
And it had the same effect as an atomic bomb, really, as the temperatures got so high. I've since heard from pilots who were in that raid, who were themselves curious in middle age as to why they'd been asked to do it, as both British and American flyers. And the principal feeling was probably been an experiment in military technology. There'd been great curiosity about whether this effect could be created with conventional weapons. It was in the nature of a scientific experiment, although they were not told this at the time. Just looking back and wondering why the hell they'd done it, that was their best guess.
It's a very gentle book. Was it the hardest one to write so far?
Well, it was the only autobiographical one, and so the difficulty was finding out what I really thought about something which had happened to me. Is to respond honestly to some event, is no other book of mine has presented that problem, and I find myself reversing the normal literary experience as I am at the end of my writing career, writing autobiographical books instead of at the beginning. As here, what, my 50th birthday is about 10 days away, and I sense that I will start writing 17-year-old books for the rest of my life.
There is one quote. I'm not going to read quotes all afternoon, but all night.
I love it.
But there's one. When you're talking about Sodom and Gomorrah, and you're also talking about Dresden, really, which I love, which is why I wanted to read. Those were about Sodom and Gomorrah officially. Those were vile people in both those cities, as is well known. The world was better off without them. And Lot's wife, of course, was told not to look back where all those people and their homes had been. But she did look back, and I love her for that, because it was so human. So she was turned into a pillar of salt. So it goes.
Yeah, and it's an apology for something else, too, because the feelings are so strong about that war, and so just, too. And one of the tragedies of our time, I think, is that we took part in a just war. I have to apologize for caring about a Nazi city, and so casting myself as Lot's wife would make me more sympathetic, maybe. But I saw my Russian translator in Paris this last weekend, and she told me that the one bureaucratic thing that happened to Slaughterhouse-5 when it was translated in, or when it was printed in Novi Mir, it was serialized in Novi Mir, is that when the galleys were all set and the presses were about to run, this bureaucrat went over the manuscript, over the galleys one last time, and the word for pillar and the word for lamppost in Russian are very close to the same. And he very carefully changed the word pillar to lamppost. So in the Novi Mir version, Lot's wife looks back and is turned into a lamppost. The same thing.
In Slaughterhouse-5, you explain that you took your daughter's crayons and a roll of wallpaper, and you made a chart. You made a chart before you made Slaughterhouse-5, showing showing the life of Billy Pilgrim, the hero, and the lives of other people in different colors, stopping when their deaths came.
Yeah, well, this was sort of a joke because I didn't actually do it. But I had a student who did at the University of Iowa, where we both taught, and student came in with a roll of wallpaper under her arm, and she unrolled it on my office floor there, face down, and she had laid out a novel this way in different colored crayons, green for this character and red for that one, And he would see a line end, and that person was dead. Or you'd see a line run off the paper, and that person had left forever at any rate. And it was a comical thing to do. It was a comical way to outline a novel. And it was very pretty, too, as you could walk up and down this piece of wallpaper and say, oh, yeah, it was almost like going to the movies. But she never wrote the book. But because, you know, her energy was completely discharged by this marvelous work of art. It's like, you know, I wish we had it now. It is indeed a novel and one of the best.
Well, Would you make a chart of your own life?
Well, I'm a little shy about this. Well, this is a piece of vaudevillian nonsense, really. But this is bringing analytical geometry to literature. This is the G-I axis. That's good fortune and ill fortune, you see. And this is the B-E axis. B for beginning and E for end. And a very popular story is a perfectly smooth sine curve. There's a, for instance, a extremely fortunate person, Nelson Rockefeller, on his wedding day, would be right here, is practically off scale for happiness, and some really miserable person would be there. But say we take a perfectly ordinary person on an ordinary day starting right here, he or she gets something he wants, becomes much happier. He loses it, becomes unhappier, gets it back, is extremely happy. And of course that's boy meets girl, boy loses girl, boy gets girl. Another equally popular story is Man in Hole. You realize this story can start anyway. You still get a nice, smooth sine curve. There's Man in Hole. The average person is going along on a regular day and something terrible happens. Because in effect, the person falls into a hole, you see. It may actually fall into a hole, gets into some sort of trouble. The person struggles, gets out of the hole, is much happier and prouder of himself because he can look back on the time he got into the hole and then got out. It becomes a person who survived the hole. And you asked me to graph my own life, and I would start about there because my father was a very successful architect, so that's where I was born, in Indianapolis. This is a nice house. And money, and the Great Depression came along, and we lost the money. That would be more my father than me, because I was young, and it was the only life I knew, so the Depression was all right with me. There was certainly enough to eat still. Anyway, the Depression was a depressing time. War was an exciting time. I liked war a lot, I would have gone to Vietnam out of curiosity and excitement. I liked the infantry. And that would have been a foolish thing for me to do, but I still would have wound up in Vietnam. And the happiest I ever was after the war was over, and I went to the University of Chicago, where I first met teachers who I thought were great men. There's Robert Redfield, who was head of the anthropology department there. I was a lousy chemist, but I just fairly good anthropologist. And after that, I would say I pooped along about there. And everything has been roughly okay, well above average. And where I am now is a thing really shouldn't terminate there because I don't intend to die quite yet. But that is my 50th birthday. Coming up in 10 days. It makes me very thoughtful. I've just finished another book, and I have a feeling it's the end of something, you know. It's all right. If I haven't lost anything, is I've completed this cycle of work. And what I'd like to do is I've, at the same time, I accumulated this hair and this mustache, and I'm a very recognizable person, and I think I'm going to take them all off. I may get a bit...
go to a court and have myself legally declared 22, which I'm going to talk to a lawyer about that. But anyway, that's where I am now, is financially. It's been a nice, steady growth curve. But I do feel that one part of me is a part of me that's been writing so far completed whatever it was supposed to do. To answer your question about where I think I am now, I'm probably just becoming 50.
Okay, the new book, what's it called?
It's called Breakfast of Champions. People here don't eat Wheaties, do they? It's a breakfast cereal, and this is the motto of Wheaties.
Wheaties, good to Wheaties.
Yes.
I remember that, but I got it from American magazines, which I read too many of when I was a kid.
It deals with the problem of I've really tried to deal with something every time. And this time I've tried to answer the question of to what extent, what part of a human being is divine and what part is a machine. And it just explores the possibilities. There's one big scene in the book is where a man is walking through a strange part of the city and a big German shepherd leaps out at him as the dog is on a leash so he can't get at the man and hurt him. But I got a physiologist to explain to me everything that happens to a human being when he's suddenly frightened. It's amazing what happens in much less than a second, the way his bloodstream changes and the way he gets coagulants in his blood so he won't leak away all his life. And the character in the book, who was me, incidentally, is getting very biographical, actually jumps over an automobile. This is a man's pure machine. And then I wonder, well, what the hell isn't mechanical? What isn't automatic? In dangerous situations, everybody behaves well. There's one thing I didn't understand about Hemingway, really, is I'm not very sympathetic with his writings anyway. But in real life, I haven't seen any cowards. And I assure you, I've met plenty of them in books, but because of chemicals, people behave extraordinarily well. I think, you know, they certainly satisfy Hemingway's standards for bravery.
You have quite a lot in your books, really, about the importance of dying a good death.
Well, this is a personal problem, something obviously shut off when I was 50. And I think I know what it is. And it was something that used to be a secret for a long time, and I finally dealt with it in the book, and it's a private matter, but there's no damn reason why it should be private. That my mother committed suicide. And so I've dealt with that, and I think probably this shut-off point here is because it was so taboo to talk about that for so long. It was a secret. The coroner helped us keep it a secret. We were a nice family in Indianapolis, and, you know, the coroner came in and was obviously a suicide, but still, it was, you know, he could write anything he wanted on the death certificate, and that was that. And so it was put down as heart failure, some damn thing. But anyway, that is really the turnoff there, and I can say that some large literary thing is going on there. But it's the very last scene in the book is under my own name, am tumbling through space. It's pleasant, it's weightless, there's nothing bad about it. And my mother is at a great distance, and she's sort of like a star. She's just a pinpoint of light there. And she won't come any closer. She won't approach any closer. She'll always keep her distance because she's embarrassed because she left me the legacy of suicide. That was the basic anxiety, I think, and the big secret I wanted to get out. And I think that a lot of people write books to tell things they're not supposed to tell. And I finally did, you know. You know the poet Jim Tate, I assume. Well, he and I were office mates at Iowa. And his father vanished during the Second World War. He's a bomber pilot, and his father never came back. And Tate wrote a poem about his father and why his father wouldn't land. And his father was embarrassed because he was dead. And the and Tate says, you know, it's all right, Dad. Nobody thinks the worse of you for it, you know. Just come on down anyway. And it was embarrassment that kept his father alive. So I guess I sort of swiped my mother's embarrassment from Tate, but I didn't think about that poem till now.
I didn't want to take you through bad times or anything
thing.
Like that.
No, scratch the whole thing. I never felt better in my whole life.
When you say you enjoyed being a soldier, I mean, I can see some ways. I don't know. I was a peacetime. At least there wasn't a war on in England at the time. There hasn't been peacetime during all my life, but I was in the English Air Force during sort of 1951, 1953. I didn't enjoy it a bit.
No,
being
I
shoved
think
around like a piece of.
No. The fun stuff is when there's a war really going on, you know. But what it was a puberty ceremony, and one of the problems with most of Western civilization is we do without a puberty ceremony, and no society has survived very comfortably without one. And so when I finally, I was an infantry scout, so I got a Thompson submachine gun, which is what Frank Sinatra gets, of course, so there was no question about my manhood once I got one of those. But no, I was a man, and you know, when I'd come home, obviously I was a man, and that was a big relief. I think another way to do it is to have a puberty ceremony, and the only puberty ceremony in the United States now is the issuance of a driver's license. And the excitement associated with this is very primitive, and it is becoming a man. And so we have a society where your puberty ceremony can be revoked, which is a shattering thing. You know, you have your driver's license lifted, and suddenly you're not a man again. And I've seen this happen to people 50 years old and older.
What would you suggest as a good puberty ceremony to introduce to
I don't care. It wouldn't make any difference as long as everybody agreed that you became a man. Of course, Jews have. This is a routine thing. There are all sorts of artificial things I want. I want everybody born into an extended family. And you can do this by just simply declaring a neighborhood your family. Mm. Or the government will say, you know, you belong to this family. I mean, that's something a government can give its people anytime it wants to, is to declare, all right, these people are your relatives, and I think, and when you're in trouble, you go to them and give them a list of 1,000 people or whatever.
Each family ought to make up its own ceremonies, though, shouldn't it?
Sure. Because
I've been to a memorial service rather than a burial, and I've been to a wedding where the people who were involved made up their own ceremony. You know, and it was planned, and it was made, and it was entirely new, and it was used once, and then,
yeah,
bunk.
Well, I had some relatives get married in Hawaii, and they went wading out into the water up to their knees, and so did the minister. It was sort of a misfire.
Another quote, another Kurt Vonnegut Jr. quote, is, you did write, we are what we pretend to be, so we must be careful about what we pretend to be. I wondered which pretenses you didn't enjoy most in your life, because you've been... Okay, apart from being a baby, a school kid, biochemistry student, soldier, well, you've said you enjoyed a prisoner, anthropology student, public relations man for General Electric.
Yeah, well, that what you just read came out of the public relations experience because,
yeah.
You know, I was chagrined to have such a job, and it was a dishonest job. And all of us who were in it, you know, we're pretending to be much better than that, really. You know, but the reality of our lives is what our lives were adding up to at that point. It was really very embarrassing.
Was that the worst bit? I mean, you know, from a work
point
of view.
It was the most embarrassing thing, yeah. As a worst thing would have been to be a military policeman, but nobody ever asked me to be one.
I can't imagine you as a public relations man, in fact. But how did you go about it, with dealing with reporters?
Well, you have to be extremely good, and one thing that made us so embarrassed in public relations in General Electric was that we'd all been honorable newspaper men at one time or another, and that we had come there purely for money, as ordinarily we made twice as much or three times as much as a local newspaper man or than we had ever made before. Where we really became shabby is when there was a strike on, some sort of labor trouble. We would suddenly start putting out all sorts of stories about hospital equipment General Electric made, you know, and General Electric on the brink of a cancer cure and that sort of thing.
When did you really break free? I mean, I know you... when did you really feel free? Because I know you broke out as a freelance writer writing short stories and things like that, but some of them you called slick and
right.
things. But
well,
when did you feel free to write?
Well, life was easier then for writers, and I'm really very sorry that the magazine industry has died out, because there used to be all these magazines to write for, and they would pay you a lot. There were six or seven very rich magazines at one time, usually coming out weekly, ravenous for stories to fill up the space between the ads. So if you could kind of tell a story, get it halfway right, you could sell it and get £200 for it to begin with. And the next story, they'd give you a raise of another £100. And so it was because they wanted you to stay in the business. And so, you know, I wrote one story because I was broke. And then this machine grabbed me, you know. Said, come on,
yeah.
My boy, you can get much richer if you'll just provide us steadily. That's all gone now.
Yeah.
And I'm so sorry, because writers in America, young writers now, have to be rich to begin with.
And since you've been free and since you've become famous writer. Yeah.
Very famous.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, you are. I did want to ask you about other writers. not because I want you to, you know, list influences or anything like that, because I think that's impossible, because I think writers are influenced by thousands of people, mm-hmm. most of them not writers at all. But I wanted to ask you about, just give you a list of writers and who I think might be something to do with what you're doing, and see if you feel any kind of,
well,
not influence, but
you know,
brotherhood.
People will ask me, and 2 days later I'll say, damn, why didn't I say who really influenced me? Because it's a reputation that's out of fashion now. It's Robert Louis Stevenson. I love the stories that man made up and the shape of them. And it's been a while since I've looked at him, so I don't know how good the prose.
Treasure Island's fantastic.
Yeah.
That's very tight. It's
yeah.
really good.
Yeah.
Let me just mention some names and see how you react to them. Names of writers. Nathaniel West.
Yeah, he startled a lot of writers because at my age,
mm.
because he was reprinted when I was about 34 or something like that. And I'd heard about him, but his books were hard to get. And then he was completely in print, and there isn't a whole lot of it. That was exciting, and that was startling. And I think that an awful lot of the joy you feel in reading somebody else's book is to know you're not alone.
Yes.
You know, that you're part of an extended family.
About Terry Southern and Joseph Heller?
Well, I know them both, and again, they are part of my extended family, and so we're glad to see each other. I think the normal experience for a writer when he meets another one is to secretly pity him for being him, although he's... I had never met James Jones before. I mean, this is a joke, you know, but writers are that sort of a machine. And I don't think you stay in business unless you sort of patronize your peers. That I did the American in Paris thing yesterday, is walked into James Jones's apartment, and we had never met, and he is our Hemingway now, geographically, you know, as you pay him a visit, and we're the same age. And I know he'll write a book sizing up all the people who came through his apartment in Paris at one time or another. And so he was a camera, and I told him so. He was amused, but I know, just because he's another writer, that he slightly pities me and I slightly pity him. They're not very
deeply.
I'd rather be you than him. But,
well, that's how I felt.
I mean, William Blake?
William Blake, yes. I like Bill and I are very good friends. And there was a time in my life when I was about 32 where everybody I ran into mentioned William Blake. And I'm not, as I say, my education was scientific, and so there was never any urgency to my reading Blake. And just my father mentioned Blake to me, and I went 600 miles away, and somebody else mentioned Blake, and so I got embarrassed and went out and bought the Modern Library Blake and read all of Blake, and it was certainly time to read Blake. It was dynamite.
What's the kind of science fiction that you don't like? And the kind that you do like?
Well, I don't write fast enough to be a real science fiction writer. Isaac Asimov, for instance, who incidentally is about the only reputable American science fiction writer who is also a scientist. He has a doctor's degree in biochemistry, which is the right field if you're going to know about what's going on. But he, in the process of getting divorced, he's divorced now, but I was talking to him, and this, he's told a lot of people this, so it's really not telling tales out of school, but I asked him what grounds his wife was going to use. He said all she has to do is say, Judge, this man wrote 110 books in the past 10 years, which is right, and I have written 10 now, and I sort of fudged on some of them, you know. Collections of things that really shouldn't be books. But I expect to, when my life is over, I will have produced about a 15th of what Asimov has produced. These guys write very fast, and I write slowly as I churn the material again and again and again. And I think part of the elation and irresponsibility when you read science fiction, most of it, the stuff that's written so fast, is it really doesn't matter.
And you have this character, Kilgore Trout, who's a science fiction writer whose books are only available in the front windows of pornographic shops.
Well, they're used as fillers between filthy pictures.
And he's a lousy writer, but he has beautiful ideas.
Yes, he has very important ideas. And in my new book, Breakfast at Champions, which will be out next April, I guess, I confront Kilgore Trout, and he knows I've created him. And it's sort of embarrassing for both of us as we meet at an arts festival out in the American Middle West. And I finally acknowledge that I did invent him, and he had imagination enough to know that maybe he was somebody in somebody else's book. And I have given him phlebitis, you know, as a disease of the circulatory system in the lower leg. I have had him write well over 100 novels and 2,000 short stories without having been paid for them, and very few of them have been published, and so forth. And I apologize to him. And since anything I say in writing happens to him because he is my creation, I arrange for him to get a decent publisher, and I arrange for him to win the Nobel Prize. I apologize to him. I've cleared up the phlebitis in his legs, and I give him his freedom. I will never use him in a book again.
You've got three children of your own and three sons adopted.
Yes.
And they're all grown up now.
Yes.
How did you raise them?
Well,
and how did they turn out?
Well, I did raise them to be pacifists, and I don't think they would even fight in a just war then, although there are a couple I'm not too sure of. But no, they have refused to serve in the United States Army. They refused to go to the Vietnam War. They were all in good health. And they are gentler than I am, as I actually have a short fuse, because I was raised to have a short fuse, is to be very sensitive to insult. And they are not, as I've seen them take extraordinary insults, and to somehow win anyway. They do better with their techniques than they would have if they'd fought. But anyway, they are generally pacifistic people, and it was my dream that they would become
physicians and lawyers and go help the poor people of the United States, something I'm not about to do, although I feel that somebody should do it. And what I have produced is a bunch of farmers. And they have no interest in the city where the American problems are. They're good farmers, but I've influenced them to have nothing to do with cities, and I suppose that's really the implication, the effect of what I write. At any rate, they have not gone far into the midst of the American fray, really. They've retreated from it. And I think that the popularity of my books among the American young must be due to the fact that somehow I am saying, go live in the woods. In any effect, that's what, in any event, that's what my children have done, which is all right. That's all right.